Okay, we're back for episode 103. Yeah, 103 of Powers and Principalities. Joe, how you doing?
Just fine, Tim. So good to be back.
Well, tonight we agreed to talk about abortion, the politics of abortion. It's been in the news in the past few months because of various state laws that have been being passed. Abortion. It's recently Alabama banned abortion, more or less. So did Georgia, Mississippi, and Ohio. They're passing very restrictive abortion laws that seem to fly in the face of Roe v. Wade. So it's a sort of a direct challenge to it. Of course, this has the left, particularly the pro-choice or pro-abortion groups, going berserk in protest to these things. One actress threatened a sex strike.
right.
So, oh no. There goes my chances. But anyway, the laws, of course, these laws are in reaction to what happened, I think, earlier this year in New York when Governor Andrew Cuomo passed a law more or less legalizing infanticide, the Reproductive Health Act, which allows for abortions all the way through full term and also allowing for failed abortions, i.e. the baby lives, allowing doctors to ignore them, more or less exposing them and letting them die. And there's also was a law proposed in Virginia but didn't pass that did the same thing. We had the governor of Virginia more or less endorsing infanticide. Abortion law in Alabama seems to be a direct challenge to the logic of Roe v. Wade. Clyde Chambliss, the state senator who carried the Alabama bill, says it's intended to create a constitutional fight. The way the bill is drafted, it goes to ask the question of personhood. The 14th Amendment gives people, a person, the right to life, liberty, and property, but it doesn't say when a person becomes a person. Obviously, if somebody is walking around, we know that it's a person. In a womb, do we know that it's a person or not? Unborn babies can hear, they can feel. At what point can they hear and feel and think and feel pain? That's interesting because Justice Blackmun's basis for the Roe v. Wade was the idea of personhood. And he just simply didn't know back then if the unborn baby, or at least he claimed not to know, that the baby was a person. Unborn baby was a person. And so what the strategy of this law is to expand the protections of personhood, of the 14th Amendment, if you will, to unborn babies. Now, under the federal law, is states can expand liberties beyond the scope of federal law, but they can't restrict it, make it more narrow than the federal law. Now, this is since 1973. This has allowed states to actually pass abortion laws that are on the books more liberal than what the federal law is, which is guided by Roe v. Wade. So what they're doing now is they're saying we're going to acknowledge the personhood, and that at least on, some people think that undermines much of the logic of Roe v. Wade, and the court will be forced to address that point, which is an interesting strategy. Now, understanding what the law is, or abortion, these things, basically the law in Georgia and Alabama, what they're saying is we've read Roe, and we're making it a very legal statement that Justice Blackmun says would fundamentally undermine the case for abortion. Under our federal system, we can expand the legal definition of life, where pro-life Americans can and do engage in good faith debates about tactics. So basically, this is the tactic, and it's very interesting. Whether it will prevail, I'm skeptical if the court will ultimately sign off on this and allow Roe to fall. But anyway, with Roe v. Wade, decision was rendered in January 1973. The Supreme Court, its companion decision was Doe versus Bolton. So you have Roe v. Wade and Doe versus Bolton. And what Roe v. Wade did was, and this is interesting because people don't get in the details of this stuff, but this was how it was set up. Roe v. Wade set up a trimester framework.
Right.
And what it did was it said the first trimester of pregnancy, the state had to leave abortion decision entirely to the woman and her physician. There's no room for regulation. The second trimester, the state could come in and regulate abortion, primarily for the purposes of regulating the physician and health and these things. So basically, the state, this is when the state could step in and start regulating abortion. Then the third trimester, the law could forbid abortion. But with its companion decision, Doe versus Bolton, it said a woman could obtain an abortion at any time for her health. And health was described as her financial, emotional, or psychological physical well-being. Basically, it legalized infanticide indirectly, and that's been on the books since then. So this is where we're set up now with this fight over abortion. We can kind of get into some of the history of abortion and these things, and some of the important figures that led the fight for legalized abortion in the United States, like Dr. Nathanson, who actually changed sides, became pro-life, and he wrote the book Aborting America. He did The Silent Scream, which made quite a splash about 25 years ago, a film exposing the brutality of late-term abortions. And he eventually converted to Roman Catholicism. That's kind of an overview of this latest controversy with abortion. It's an interesting challenge to the abortion regime, because really there's been, I think, in the public opinion, there's been a significant rising support for what we would call anomaly pro-life position. Most people are against abortion on demand or late-term abortions. But the law, the way the law is, the way that the Supreme Court has imposed the law, 7-3, pretty much allows for that. And prior to this, of course, various states regulated abortion on their own terms. And in about 30 states, abortion was strictly restricted. A few states, it was very liberal. And the turning point was the late 60s, 1970, when New York, Hawaii, I think Washington, and California, and Alaska legalized abortion past the point of viability. And this was kind of the turning point. But it's interesting because that represented sort of the values of those states. But the most of the country, abortion was severely restricted. It was the Supreme Court, through judicial activism in the 1970s, which imposed this abortion-on-demand legal regime in the United States, giving the United States probably the distinction of having the most liberal abortion laws in the world. So that's kind of my initial take on it.
Well, it's a contested issue, isn't it? It's been a great political issue for both parties, in that it's been a huge fundraiser. It's one of the ways that our antiquated political parties are able to take money from the public, because there's so much passion concerning it. If you look at the public support for Roe, it's been over basically 55%. Most, according to the Harris poll, which, I mean, I don't know how accurate it is. I'm just, reciting the Harris poll. So in general, there is public support. It's over 50%. Right now, it's actually kind of waned. It's down to just about 50%. Mm-hmm. But the strong opposition to Roe has also declined. So in other words, there's a large group of Americans that seem to be dropping out of the issue. But it's still, I think, the most intense emotional issue that we have in America, in my opinion. It's the one, if you go to a cocktail party and you want to have a fight with someone, say, let's talk about Roe. you can guarantee there'll be some passion. And I think that it's designed to produce that. I've taken the position that Hillary and Donald were selected because they elicit hate. Right. And because you hate one or the other, then democracy what is presented as democracy has meaning, because you have emotion, and you want someone to lose, if nothing else, And I think that politically, the Roe v. Wade has been manipulated for that purpose, for a number of purposes. But I think that the first thing that I would, from trying to try to express my opinion about it, is that the dialectic is basically fake, okay, like so many things. And I don't know if you've ever seen these numbers. I was looking at them this week, but in the states that have enormous amounts of abortion, like New York, California, Texas, the support for Roe is very, very strong, right? But in the states that have very few abortions, there Roe has almost no support at all. So my point is, if you actually got rid of Roe v. Wade, I don't think you'd really affect the actual numbers of abortion that were, performed in the United States, because the states would, in the large abortion using states, they would continue the policy, because there, like in New York and California, for example, it's like a 65-70% political winner.
Yeah, it's the abortion mills will still run in those states.
Yeah, exactly. So the thing is that, and then of course, you also have the idea that, if you want an abortion and the state has banned it, you can, of course, just take a bus or something. And I'm sure that you can imagine if this was an organized function of American society. Say you had 15 states that kicked Roe out. You don't think they could organize some transportation for women to go to the Planned Parenthood centers across the state border?
Well, it's funny, the Planned Parenthood, one of its responses to this very situation where the clinics simply don't exist, even states where abortion is legal and technically available, these places have been run out of the states, either just by protest or shaming them. And so Planned Parenthood created abortion mega centers, almost like abortion Walmarts.
Yeah, that's so, exactly right. Yeah. And so the thing is that I would this is, in my opinion, correct. And this is why we have basically a fake political issue. It's something that is used to create interest in democracy. That the idea that we have to keep the Supreme Court from Roe v. Wade, and so Clarence Thomas becomes this big passionate battle, and as if the Supreme Court is going to do anything that really is going to be dramatically different than the desires of the oligarchs, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it's just ridiculous, and so. So it's just this is the political aspect of Roe, is that it really creates intense emotion, but it isn't a real issue. It's just not a real issue numerically. Now, this is one of those things that people can, hate upon me for saying. They can say, you're not a woman. You're not ever faced this situation. The supporters of abortion, they can just go berserk, and.
Yeah, that's true. More actually, if you break it down, actually, more women tend to be pro-life more often than men.
So. Right, I know. Actually, it's ironic, isn't it?
You talk to my wife about that, right?
Yeah, but anyway, the thing is that
because you're not dealing with it's irrelevant point, because you're not dealing with the fundamentals of the issue. It's personhood and. Whether it's a human life or not. Yeah, it doesn't matter what sex you are.
Yeah, and you see, and the thing is, the one of the reasons, I think they use this political issue is that it's not an issue that can ever be what I would call falsified. In other words, you're never going to have a conclusion to this issue. It's impossible, right? There will always be people who will oppose abortion, and there will be people who feel that it's appropriate, and the arguments that each side make, I don't think, will never falsify the opponent argument to the extent that they will take it. They will wipe it out.
Yeah, by nationalizing, they created an intractable political issue.
Exactly,
and I think insoluble one. It's no way at a national level this can be resolved. When it was at the state level, you had laws, for better or for worse, being more liberal or more conservative. And it wasn't quite the dialectic that they want, or nor was it a fundraising ploy,
Exactly right. And that's what we're dealing with, is that they took it away from the states just to have it at the national level as a false dialectic to create some interest in their democratic facade.
Yeah, but I was reading Bernard Nathanson's excerpts from his book, Aborting America, and he's talking about the strategy they employed. Him and Lawrence Lader, the one that started the national association for reproductive, or it was Brigade was NARA, I forget the acronym was, basically became National Abortion Rights Action League, but they were for the national, it was called the National Association for the Repeal of Abortion Laws or something. I think it was the organization's original name, and part of their strategy was to recruit the feminists, Because originally there wasn't much female support for abortion, is interesting enough. So they recruited the feminist. But from the get-go, the biggest supporter of abortion rights was Playboy.
Well, and that makes perfect sense.
Makes perfect sense, yes.
Because what you're you know, you have to remember is that there is a larger picture.
Yeah. Okay. So you have when I'm reading this, they point out as an ironic point. But I said, well, that makes perfect sense. There's no contradiction there.
Right. I mean, it's like it's listeners to our show will make it. They'll just go ho hum. Of course.
Yeah.
You know, because the idea of unbridled sexuality is something the oligarchs are trying to achieve. We've shown over and over again how specific they are about they wanted to unbridle sexuality as a way to demolish family structure.
It was right? Like when in the 80s, when Hugh Hefner had an AIDS fundraiser.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Just keep the pornography coming. And, you know, and so this is the bigger picture is that the abortion fits into basically the unbridled sexuality, because inside a family, abortion, I think, is a lot less an issue. Right. I mean, typically, particularly in traditional families, you know, you would look forward to pregnancy. This wouldn't be, you know, I mean, and the idea of aborting a child would almost be, you know, unless there was real physical danger to the woman, would just, it wouldn't be in the kind of world I grew up in. I grew up in, when we came back from Japan, where I didn't really have a chance to interact with the broad society. I was kind of a little cloistered, you know, private school world. But when I came back, we lived in Torrance. Okay, that's just a middle class beach community in Southern California. And the community was pretty close. I mean, you got to know all, because everyone had kids, right? It was mm-hmm. a baby boomer, and all, we were a lot of Catholic families. Everyone had kids. And everyone had lots of kids. And it was like something that was just perfectly fine. No one seemed to be upset with a family with six kids or seven kids, or like in my case, we had nine kids, right? It was just, hey, this is great, more kids. What's the problem, you know? But this, of course, caught the attention of the oligarchs, and are not just at this time during the baby boomer, but they've always wanted to find a way to genocide certain populations.
Yeah,
right?
Well, this predates the sexual revolution, at least it's unfolding or rollout, because The fact of the matter is that single people, particularly young girls, were much more chaste than they are today. So therefore, it wasn't simply a problem.
Right, exactly.
And people behave differently, and this is how abortion. Reason why abortion and the contraceptive issues, you know, Griswold v. Connecticut, and then abortion 8 years later with Roe v. Wade, is that the abortion had to be expanded. Abortion rights, abortion on demand, had to be expanded, along with, because you think about it, wait a second, if people are using more contraceptives, why do you need abortion? Well, the whole philosophy on contraceptives. I mean, the hidden grammar was sexual license, and sexual license leads ultimately to depopulation, ironically, because you break down the familiar structure, which supports population growth and kids being raised and these things. But there's a reason why the sexual revolution, you had to have abortion, because the baby is a reminder what sex is all about. Sex isn't free. There isn't such things as free love, because there's consequences, and it's a child that needs to be cared for. And for that, you have to be obligated to the person with whom you created that child with, and all that. You can't have a sexual revolution, and if people are accepting those, broadly accept those rules and those responsibilities. So,
well, if family is the important goal,
yeah,
I think now with the you know, the advent of the 50 and now even the 60-year-old pornographic male, and the single mom who is now sometimes the single mom, single grandmother, you know, I mean, you've got generations of non-husband structured families, right, in mm-hmm. a row in some cases. People can see that we've been taken off a cliff culturally. And by that, I mean that our experiences are miserable. You know, where we hate life. I mean, you know, I just actually spent a day with a friend of mine, you know, guy I knew in high school. He's just turned 70, God help us, and was reflecting on his life, and it was just listening to him talk, you could just see the agony that he had never developed a family. He went full throttle into the sexual revolution, drugs, right? They were part of the whole thing. And then his life just drifted. He thought that this was, at the time, he was pursuing freedom, doing his own thing, sex, drugs, and rock and roll. Well, I'll tell you, when you get to be 70 and you're alone, it isn't so much fun anymore.
It's really your own thing.
It is your own thing, right? And there,
All alone,
it is all your own thing, So you've really been a
Well, that's
rebel.
what it's like. You get married. Okay, and you have children, and you put all your energy into supporting your spouse and your children, and that makes it puts everything in perspective, puts everything in context, and also it makes getting older, acceptable, not miserable, because it's just a part of your life, and you can look back and whatever, your children, your family is some sort of a, and you can be at ease with yourself. Whereas if you're always out there trying to, like you said, the guy dyeing his hair 50 old at the singles club, that's pathetic.
It is pathetic. I'm telling you.
It's
I mean, that's a pathetic thing to see. And
yeah.
but it's I actually have a an opinion, and that we are such social animals, and this has been sort of our real nature has been kept from us because the oligarchs have had this idea about shattering the family and shattering ethnicity, that we don't even appreciate the extent that we feel correct and right in the world, in a family, and in a an extended community of of like kind of ethnic families. It is just the most comfortable, natural place for all of us to be. Everybody on the planet. This is just where
Yeah, no one feels unfulfilled. No one feels unfulfilled.
You don't. These kinds of neurosis and existential angst, that they're giving the kids Prozac on the university for, they don't exist in the world of families. They really don't. I mean, yeah, look, I know I'm kind of, romanticizing it and maybe juxtaposing it because there are, of course, as there are like lots of problems when you have families.
Yes.
Just I'm talking in the broad stroke.
Yeah.
And this whole idea about, the misery of existence, it doesn't happen because when you have teenage daughters, you don't have to have some kind of existential fantasy about a miserable existence. You really have a miserable existence. I mean, it's just, what I'm talking about. It's,
Yes, I do. Yes.
but it is so, it is in many ways, you'll never have such a fulfilling, in the sense of filling up your soul. You really, because these issues are real, these problems are they are part of your very being. And when you can solve them, when you can have communication and there is some way that there's been growth and these problems are resolved, it is the greatest feeling imaginable. On the converse, when they fail, you'll never know greater pain.
Yes,
But
exactly, yeah.
that is the meaning of life. That's how critical and that's how interesting it is. See, this is kind of what I'm trying to say, is that it's way more interesting than the pornographic male. And certainly it's more interesting than poor single mom, with the government paycheck. And like or even the career woman, right? That's a model now that's being promoted on TV so much, that they don't even mention families. They're just these powerful women. They're competing with men for money, right? And so
Yeah, what
that's
kind of society puts its 20 women in their 20s in the workforce?
the
They say
same kind
that,
of would put them on the front lines.
yeah, and we're getting moving in that direction too.
Of course, so because they're trying to sexuality is being attacked just like the family was, because this is all going to the Brave New World. It ends up with intellectual stratification, deltas and epsilons. And the state, and the main thing that people have to remember is that this all ends up with the state producing the children. That's why public education is being, you can see that with the mandatory vaccination, with the cultural Marxist pedagogy. I mean, they are getting really close to it, you know, where people don't even understand how through incrementalism they've been led into a position where the state is creating the values in the child, you know. And so that's kind of where birth control has taken us. And Jim, I know this will probably, I can already see the or hear the listeners rolling their ears when I bring this stuff up. But I just wanted to mention a couple things. If you go back to kind of the formation of birth control as a concept, you know, you have some really, you know, a couple of very famous women. You know, you have Margaret Sanger and Annie Besant. Sanger is the founder of Planned Parenthood, and Besant is the one who really kind of, you know, broke. She had a trial. She had all these books and pamphlets and stuff. And so they brought the idea of, you know, kind of that how birth control was better for the planet in general, but was being kept from women as a kind of domination by males, you know. But the thing that, you know, I think is important is these two women came from completely different trajectories. You know, they're not like, you know, Lodge brothers or something. They come from different worlds, different times. But what unified them is they're both theosophists. They're both followers of Blavatsky. And I just think that this is, you know, this is the red flag, you know, that you can see that that they're not useful idiots. They're actually agents of some kind, you know, that you're dealing with a kind of a program, because there's simply no way that, you know, we've gone through a couple of shows where we trace sort of all of the influences of the Theosophical Society and like the production of World War II and the Nazi Party. And there's just this overwhelming kind of centrifugal energy that no matter where, what you're talking about, you're talking about the money, the anti-Semitism, the economics, philosophy, you know, all that, it all always at the core, when you get down to it, there's someone who has, you know, been set in motion by Blavatsky. And then to see that these two characters both come from Blavatsky, I just think it's the, you know, it's obviously the red flag. And then when you look at like Margaret Sanger, her explanation as to why she's attracted to it, I mean, she just couldn't be more of a racist kind of, you know, she would simply, her positions would be, you couldn't even give them, I mean, you'd be arrested at a, you know, Ivy League school, right? If you took the position that Sanger was using to justify the overall concept of birth control, because she talked about inferior races, and she was basically just out and out eugenics, right? She was saying they're human weeds, we need to pull them, you know, and so.
Well, she used to say things like the kindest thing you can do to a child in a large family is kill it.
Yeah. Exactly. But and see, this comes up over and over again, and you look, when you actually go into the philosophy of the people that are supposedly being, you know, trying to help mankind with this birth control or to free women, right?
Yeah.
Then you scratch the surface a little bit and you go, wait a second, these aren't people who have, you know, some kind of humanitarian perspective. They have some very, very, you know, kind of cutting edge and evil, motivation that is hidden. You see, and this is the thing, is that we're dealing with a hidden agenda when you get into the history of the birth control and Planned Parenthood. And so when you look at Planned Parenthood's track record now, and you know, even today, it's sort of, for a long time, Planned Parenthood was saying that abortion wasn't its primary mission. I don't know if you've been following this semantical battle, but now it's just out in the open, because a lot of the statistics are out. They did like 350,000 abortions last year.
Yeah, and they get federal funds.
And they're being funded. Sorry. So in other words, it's just preposterous. Of course, that's what they are.
It's
They're.
funny thing is, I don't think the founders of the Ku Klux Klan ever said anything as anti-black as Margaret Sanger.
No, you couldn't even
I
say it, you know, and
mean,
so.
they never advocated aborting. They never advocated aborting, killing black babies.
Well, but you have to remember that. You know, Sanger is a follower of Blavatsky, and Blavatsky had, you know, when she was setting up the Nazi Party, she was putting into motion these ideas of racial superiority and racial inferiority, right? And this was being done because you wanted to create you know, you wanted to create nations for the purpose of using them in warfare. Right, to unify nationalism, to make it very, you know, the intense patriotism. If you look at, anyway, I won't segue too far into that, but this was all part of how they can, you know, maneuver Europe as a chess pieces on a chessboard into destroying itself. Well, here we have just another project. And, you know, I mean, just think about this was kind of the thought I had is that, you know, you look at World War I. Right, which, you know, with the Archduke's, you know, Masonically controlled license plate, right? Everyone can see that this is ludicrous and that the war is just a, you know, an operation of a, you know, for the purpose of genocide. And then after the war, you have the so-called Spanish flu, right? Remember, I don't know how many, 25 million people died from this thing, which of course comes in this very mysterious way from some kind of military base, right, where there was some
Fort Riley,
special,
Texas.
yeah, some sort of experiment with vaccines was going on. I mean, who knows? You know, we just it wasn't really a flu, it was some kind of a thing, but I mean, you know, over my pay grade. But so you have this, and then you have World War II, you know, where you have, you know, what, 60 million people killed. In between you have Homolador, right? Where you've got 20, 30 million people killed. And now you come to the 60s, right? And then suddenly you have the population bomb and the baby boomer, right? And you go, well, wait a second. Wait a second. We just lost a couple hundred million people over the last 100 years. How can there possibly be too many? Why would we be using these expressions, right? I really, you know, I'll tell you the truth, Tim. This is a paranoid thought, rare for me to have one. But a couple of years ago, I was traveling through France, and I couldn't get over how depopulated the country was. Yeah, just depopulated. You know, there's Paris, you know, there's the towns along the Mediterranean, Provence. But, you know, I was talking to people there. They would have to have a school. They would have to amalgamate the children from like 10 different villages because there was no kids. And, you know, farmers markets that had existed for hundreds of years were now out of business because they didn't have the population.
Well, between the wars, abortion, and contraception, and just, you know, people not forming families, what does that do to the population? Jeez.
Exactly. But see, my point is, I don't buy the numbers, particularly like the European numbers. I really think that this is being manipulated, that they're not really releasing the how rapidly the European population is evaporating. Because, you know, and I also know I haven't been there recently, but I was told that in Germany the same thing was happening. That there were villages that were just depopulated. The whole centers of the towns of the country just didn't have population in it. I mean, I hope I'm wrong, and I would have, you know, I'm not in a position where I could prove this thought, but I think it's something people should be at least concerned about, is that if you look at the depopulating historical events, Spanish flu, World War I, you know, Holodomor, things like this, these are in such hundreds of millions. The idea that you know, you have to have this draconian abortion campaign. As a way of creating a stable ecosystem, right? Because remember, this is how it's being sold. They're saying, you know, like, I don't know, you've seen the Georgia Guidestones. where they talk about we need to have like only 400 million people. I think that's the number they give on the world, which would mean, you're going to have like 7 billion kind of leave the earth.
Yeah, if that's how many people are. I mean, they say there's 7 billion,
Right,
but
exactly. So
yeah.
I don't, but anyway, so excuse me, but the point is that it would seem to me that we really want to have a better grip on our numbers because I just think that there is just a very dramatic decline in the population of like Europeans that isn't being reported accurately. I talked to someone who was in an Irish woman who was I was talking to in New Zealand a couple months ago, and she said that Ireland is sort of like Sweden. She said there's just so many immigrants. She said that the place is so grungy that she left. And it's funny because I hadn't even heard really, it was a news story. I mean, you hear about Sweden, you hear about Paris,
Yeah,
where
I
they.
think Irish Prime Minister is a homosexual Indian ethnic.
Yeah, and that's why you gave the Irish demographic philosophy, which, I mean, I have to admit, even though it's maybe, I don't know, vulgar of me, I had to laugh when you gave the expression. You said it was abort and import. That they would just abort all of the children of the, European background and import basically people from the former Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, it's another thing is, since why would Ireland be a destination point for people from North Africa or Middle East? It doesn't strike me as a
Yeah, that's right. You're not sitting there in Morocco going, if only I could get to Dublin, my life would just turn around, because I like Guinness Stout, or I mean, who knows? But it's just the forces of the EU oligarchs to, that are moving, they're moving all, they're immigrating to all this. It obfuscates, I think, the decline in the native populations. People don't notice it as much because there are still bodies coming, to occupy homes. But the native populations, man, they're all under attack, in my opinion. And so abortion, it's this, as we experience in America, it's a really intense political phenomenon. It's but on a large scale, man, I just think it's basically an aspect of genocide.
Well, it's part of the culture of death, which is part of the New World Order. It's the inability. I mean, just the belief in believing that there's such thing as an inconvenient life you can just brush aside and kill to get out of your way, that sort of thing. And that's that. Justifying that type of outlook and behavior. It's interesting to point out the whole the abortion regime itself was always founded upon lies, and Bernard Nathanson admitted that himself. He was, I think, it was personally responsible for 75,000 abortions himself before he converted. But he admitted that when they were campaigning or advocating for legalized or liberalized abortion laws, they knowingly just wildly exaggerated the number of deaths from illegal botched abortions by a factor of like 1,000. They just lied, and no one checked them. This is because no one checked the sources or where they're getting this. But they claimed they're like anywhere from 5,000, 10,000 women dying a year from illegal abortions. The whole coat hanger meme was always made up, and it turned out there was more like 150 reported. He estimated about 500 a year nationwide. And also Roe v. Wade, Norma McCur Nor Norma McCorvey was the plaintiff in that, and she admitted at the time of Roe v. Wade, it was claimed that she had been raped, and it turns out she wasn't raped. It was a lie. She was told to tell by feminist lawyers who are using her as a prop or as a proxy. She eventually became pro-life, actually. And of course, her daughter, who the subject of that case, of course, is still alive. But there was a lie; she was not raped. So the whole rape and incest thing is a red herring used to, justify a wildly liberal abortion regime. So.
Can I ask you like a question, a personal question about abortion? In other words, and please don't answer if you're uncomfortable. I'm just curious. Like, Would you give us your personal feeling on abortion? In other words, do you think, I mean, for example, like if there is legitimate risk to the mother to bring the child to term, which kind of a strange idea, but is that, if that was the case, would there ever be a you know, I know you're a Catholic, but would there be a, are there moments when abortion is are permitted?
Like an ectopic pregnancy.
Yeah.
It's when you're a tubular pregnancy. That's, to my mind, the only case. Any other thing is I think, is from a health standpoint, the abortion is much more physically risky to the mother, particularly, well, it's always risky to the baby.
Pretty much.
So you have that case, you have the ectopic pregnancy, and that's where the law of second effect kicks in, justifying the abortion, meaning that you're there to save the mother, and the second effect is killing the baby, would never develop, and it's killing the mother. There are cases, tough cases, where, you know, a mother comes down with a disease. This is the case of cancer, and you have to go on their chemotherapy, and the woman says, no, I want to give birth, and she ends up dying of cancer because she doesn't go under chemotherapy, these things. Now, you and I both talked about, you know, cancer treatment, the standard care, and that whole thing.
Yeah.
So right. I don't, it's hard, then you're getting into the controversy, you know, of modern medicine and what it really is and how do we treat these things. And really, is there a better way to treat cancer that would save both mother and child? I know that pediatricians or doctors, obstetricians, when the woman signals that she wants to give birth, treats the mother and the unborn baby as two separate patients. You know, so that's how it's done. Then when she wants to kill her unborn child, then all of a sudden it's her body, her choice. You know, the laws make no sense because the laws, a woman can still demand that the father support the child he sired, but he has no say in the matter, whether the baby is born or not. I mean, the woman has unilateral decision to, even if they're married, by the way, to kill the unborn. This doesn't happen too often for obvious reasons, but nevertheless, that's with the laws. But the law still imposes responsibility on the father to help raise that child, at least legally, you know, with child support, despite the fact that he has no rights in the matter. You know,
yeah,
doesn't seem to make any sense.
Yeah, you know, good points. I think that these questions can't really ever be resolved completely. You know, in terms of just analytic process, there's always going to be two sides to the story, and so.
But the point is that again, the current regime was imposed by judicial fiat, by judicial activism, and was done to nationalize the issue. Despite Ruth Bader Ginsburg, a year or so ago, she was perplexed that the issue wasn't resolved by the court. Well, it's never going to be resolved by the court. They can't resolve that.
It's not intended to resolve. It's intended to just always be a distracting, inflammatory, emotion-filled issue that creates a dialectic so people think democracy's actually occurring, you know, if it's...
But you can't take abortion outside the sexual revolution, outside the issues of human sexuality and these things, because once you separate sex from procreation, from the creation of human life, you corrupt it, you deny its logos, its meaning, and if you acknowledge that meaning, then these issues are moot anyway. So the whole point is trying to bring people back to the logos, understanding what it's all about. Because that way you get rid of the narcissism. And if you get rid of the narcissism in these things, you'll lower the death toll, because people will then have a proper outlook on these things.
Right? Well, you'll have them wanting to, I think, to be part of family.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, logos or logos is a complicated idea.
My point is, it wasn't just.
I understand how you're using it, though, and it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, it wasn't just because, you know, even. Feminists were originally against abortion. They saw it as a way to they rightly saw.
Yeah.
If you separate pregnancy from sex, women are going to be used. And that's precisely what Paul VI wrote about in Humana Vitae, the encyclical 1968. He said if you, this was specifically about contraception, but he saw contraception as being inextricably linked to abortion, because abortion now is a form of contraception. I mean, in a crude sense. I mean, obviously, because it's a conception, but it's a form of birth control. And he saw it's just an extension of birth control. If you have contraception, you're going to have abortion. given the logic of contraception. And he predicted this, the church, and they were right. They predicted if you did this, you'd have exploitation of women, proliferation of pornography and sex and culture and these things, the sexualization of the culture. And this is what happened. Because if you debase sex, you debase human life. You cannot separate the two, because sex is there to generate human life. And sex, properly understood, it's there to be an act of love. And it's an act of love. The child that's created has a support system. That's called a family. You know?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was, you know, because you hear the argument about abortion being needed to protect the life of the mother, right? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, that's, you know, I mean, okay, it seems like a reasonable idea anyway. And then I was studying this in the last week, trying to find, well, how often does this happen?
Yeah.
This is sort of like the organic transvestite. It's are like the unicorn. There just isn't examples of this.
Yeah, it's the red herring they pull out.
It's so rare. It's just almost, you know, it's like a statistical zero.
It's like in that movie Cider House Rules with Michael Caine. It was about the heroic abortion doctor performing illegal abortions in New Hampshire during World War II or something. And he performs an abortion. One of the abortions is a black teenage girl that's brought in who's been impregnated by her father. So you know, they really so they create the most extreme circumstances to justify what he's doing.
Problems, you know, that you have to solve, you know. And in fact, I think that it was I actually saw that movie. It was on I don't know exactly why I saw it, but maybe it was on Netflix, and I mm-hmm. for some, I actually saw that movie. It was just a horrible movie, incidentally. Just don't watch that movie. But I think it was that woman Charlize Theron.
Charlize Theron was in it. Yes,
she was the romantic lead, if you want to call it that. And then she's now basically raising a boy as a girl, I believe.
Yes, yeah.
My memory serves, you know, and so it's just kind of interesting how it all sort of just has this kind of logical kind of.
Like, well, isn't it? She adopted a black boy. From Africa, who thinks
said when he was like 4 years old, I think
he says he's a girl. And who was it who has the girl, the black girl who identifies as a boy?
I think that's Pink.
Pink, and so your idea was just get them together and it'll all work out.
I mean,
zeroes itself out.
We have to get these kids together. You know? Well. Good God. I mean, so I when I couldn't really find examples of this. I actually was going through the medical, I know they exist. I just was, you know, my research kind of failed me. And then the other thing is like pregnancy via rape, as in the Cider House Rule movies, you know, where it's like, well, how often does this happen? I mean, there are examples, but there's not even like, I couldn't find five or six examples, and yet, if when they make the argument into the television set, the talking heads, they will go, you know, abortion because the woman's been raped, and or if the having the child will kill the woman, they talk about these things like, well, these are just common everyday things. We've just got to have unbridled abortion, because otherwise you'll have like all of these women dropping dead during pregnancy.
So now, being raped, having to give birth from a rape, that's all horrible. But then that's also equated to a girl who gets pregnant might have to drop out of school for a semester.
So this is, you know, you get, this is the thing. This is how very difficult it is, because you know, there are examples. It's like when you point out the reason that the oligarchs want multiculturalism, and you try to bring this argument to someone whose parents are of, you know, different races, and and that individual will stand there and, you know, try to basically proudly represent his real humanity. You know, well, what do you say to this individual? You try to point out that, well, what we're talking about is the weaponization of these aspects of behavior, these weaponization, you know, and that you know, it isn't about the individual. So in the case of abortion, you have this problem of, you know, I'm sure they can always bring a woman into the argument who, you know, I was raped, I have to have the abortion. But it's really, that really isn't the more important question, which is, has this all been weaponized? Mm-hmm. Are you in a process of just having your ethnicity reduced to zero?
Well, that's the thing, is the issue of abortion itself as a product, the fact that it becomes such a controversial issue, a public policy issue, is a symptom of a debased society. Because, for example, the 1940s and 50s, it wasn't, even going into the 60s, it wasn't on everyone's radar as a controversial issue, because the way they lived their lives was in families, so it just wasn't something that was thought of. You'd have to get done. If you did get done, if you're a movie star because you're impregnated by some movie producer or something, you go to Mexico and get it taken care of. But it wasn't just because of antiseptics that made abortion viable. It was the whole sexual revolution, which was unleashed. It wasn't something that developed naturally. People's, you know, just as their options. It was almost wasn't like a sort of the Whig form of history where it's expanding liberty and we're progressing. It was imposed upon the country via the sexual revolution, which was from the get-go created by Hollywood, the think tanks, the publishing houses, Time Life, and, you know, the foundations.
You know, it's like, You have and my memory, because, you know, and I guess I'm at the point now where I'm able to, because of my antiquity, to legitimately you know, like, just talk anything about anything I want, because I can always say, well, I couldn't remember because I'm so old. Mm-hmm. But I'm pretty sure this is true. My memory is bringing this up, that Dianne Feinstein and our other California senator, Helen Boxer, I think her name was, this is about 10 years ago.
Oh, Barbara Boxer, yeah.
Barbara Boxer. They were, I'm so close with these people, you know, anyway, they were talking about Roe v. Wade, and there was, you know, the Supreme Court, when the Supreme Court nominee is, you know, being brought forward, this is when the issue is always rolled out, right? That we have to stop, you know, this individual from becoming Supreme Court justice because we have to protect Roe. And they were saying, you know, we don't ever want to go back. We don't want to go back. We don't want to go back to that era. And in the advertising, they had a coat hanger.
Yes.
Which was the symbol of the abortion that, right. And, you know, this is real. It's really interesting how such a, you know, it's not just, you know, propaganda, it's just debased, you know, kind of way of like conditioning people, that is really so effective, you know, that's it's really visceral, you know, to women, I think, particularly, that they go, oh my God, you know, we'll go backwards, and I won't have the antiseptic and safe abortion that I need, you know, as part of my reproductive freedom. And yet it never, at least rarely, are they being opposed on the grounds, wait a second, you really want to go back to 1950. Because, you see, the fact that there was an abortion isn't because women weren't free. It's just the opposite. It's because they were. And they were unable to actually do kind of the normal things that females will do in a free way, which is to form families.
Yes. Yeah.
See? But they've been able to get at the, you know, the minds of women with these graphic representations, you know, of like going backwards. And I mean, it's sort of like the pornographic male.
Well, how are you free? If the only way you can be free is you take chemicals to alter your hormonal balances in your body, which cause all types of health problems, or you flush them half down the drain, so people are forced to take in those hormones when they drink the drinking water.
God, I mean, it's just a good point.
Where's the liability with that? I want some responsibility for that, because that's explaining a lot of the health problems and also developmental problems that people are having.
Yeah, I mean, just to digress, I was reading that in Seattle, they have been testing oysters in Puget Sound. Mm-hmm. And they have detectable levels of heroin and heroin synthetics. Mm-hmm. you know, it gets flushed, you know, out of people's urine and I guess in other ways, but there's so much Oxycontin and fentanyl use in Seattle that it's actually detectable in the poor oysters who are all stoned out of their mind, you know? And so it's, you know, this is a tragic situation, but that use of pain-killing drugs shows you that the culture is sick, right? And abortion, even though, you know, as I said, you could never stand, you know, in an individual moral battle. And this is like if they can get this, you know, where you're denying a woman who was raped the ability to have an abortion, right? And you see, this is the thing, is that I don't think that was ever really the case. I think in these weird exceptions, they were just so rare.
Yeah.
I think people were able to, from, you know, quite often to find a way to actually terminate the pregnancy. But they were just so very rare. I mean, truly rare, you know, one in 100,000 or something, that it just wasn't part of the culture.
Yeah.
The idea that, you know, women were needing abortion right and left, that's a mythology that they've created just to, you know, to keep us in check and to keep us more moving toward the brave new world.
Well, can't take these outlier events for general policy. It's ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah, you know? Exactly.
And so then we have to tolerate 4,000 abortions a day. You know, often women who have multiple abortions use it as a form of birth control because every so often you might have a rape victim or something. That's ridiculous. And this, you know, if you really want to do this, is have laws only allow for rape and incest, and let's adjudicate it. Those cases based on that, and you have to prove it if that's the case, you know. That's just an excuse, you know.
And but you know, and it's sort of like the transvestite, you know, they create the gay culture and mythology, and then they call it
freedom.
Right. And then, but they also then create the reality with the physiological debasement, where you have all of the plastic synthesizers, you know, creating estrogen, the sperm count goes way down, and suddenly kind of the effeminate male becomes more and more frequent. So it's a two-prong attack. You have the culture, and then you have, you know, the physiological.
Well, that's the occulted reality there. Because when someone like a Feinstein, who says, you know, we can't go back, women need to have the opportunity to do interesting things, as they say, interesting things, have careers. It's assumed that a woman has the choice of a career or having a family. That's not true, because as the culture is warped or shaped to presume that women should have careers or jobs, and this also goes along with other psychological warfare or social engineering schemes, which change the environment, meaning that there simply aren't there isn't the support mechanism for men to be wage earners, nor is there the support mechanism for men to be healthy masculine men to be, you know, provider protectors. So the woman no longer has the option of having a family and having a husband take care of her, because the overall economy and society no longer supports that. In fact, it's opposed to that. It's hostile to that environment. So there isn't an either or a choice. It just simply isn't the case. And let's face it, all talk about women having choices. When have men have choices? It's still presumed when a man gets married that he works full time, works more. Women now say, well, I could have the choice. Well, no. The fact of the matter is, in a healthy society, men sacrifice their home life for their career, for working to take care of their families, and women will sacrifice their quote career to take care of their families. They'll do it subconsciously. They'll just do it because that's what you do to have a family. That's how you nurture the second, you know, the next generation, invest time in your kids. But it's not as if we live in a society where women have the opportunity for these things, because the society itself has become so hostile to those traditional families, and is you know, economics, tax policy, entertainment, you know, information, education, it's completely hostile to these things. So even if a woman wants to do that, she has to really work hard, have to work, go against the grain of society to set up that type of lifestyle. We'll be very lucky that she meets a man who can
think about life. Think about someone coming through the UC system, University of California, going through like 4 years of cultural Marxism, feminism, gender study, queer study. I mean,
they're so addled by the time they graduate.
Exactly. How would that individual look at family, an ordinary heterosexual family? Yeah. I mean, it would just be, you'd look at it askance, you know, you'd wonder if it was a good moral idea. Of course, you couldn't help it, you know, if you'd been brainwashed for 4 years of these things. And it's just, and remember the intimidation. Remember the cultural Marxist intimidation that, it's not like you have competing ideas. It's not like you have a promotion of the family sociological class, right? Mm-hmm. No, you just have queer theory, the problems of the transgender, and then of course, you know, the historic struggle for Roe v. Wade.
Yeah, and that's something, when you look at the history of abortion itself, the legal history of abortion, the first laws, I think, were passed in the 1820s, all the way through the 1870s. American Medical Association came out against it in the 1870s and these things. But the laws restricting it were non-sectarian, nor did it have anything to do with Catholicism. Since the 1960s, there's been the case, or at least it's been sort of suggested that somehow the only group really opposing abortion are the Catholics. And that's largely true since the 60s. But that wasn't the case historically. And that's why now, to this day, when you mention names like Feinstein, you know, questioning judicial nominees who are Catholic, asking them about their dogma, you know, you're a Catholic. No one ever asked Ruth Bader Ginsburg about, you know, her position in the Talmud, and that will affect her jurisprudence, not to mention her lifelong activism, you know, as an advocate, putting her on the bench, thinking she's going to adjudicate or do an objective or a fair reading of the Constitution. Obviously, she's going to advocate from the bench. But then again, you can't ask a Jewish nominee of the Supreme Court about the Talmud, but you can go on and on about Catholics and dogma.
Yeah, I mean those are true points, and that's just the power of intimidation that. People will look at the TV, they'll see the nomination process moving along, and these obvious questions never come up. They aren't even on the table. I mean, no one wonders why Catholics are put through, that their religion becomes a point of, legitimate, interrogation.
Yeah. Now, it is interesting about these various abortion laws that were passed. You know, we opened this up with the law in Georgia, Ohio, Alabama, and was it Missouri? And these are at the state level, and I applaud the laws, and I do like the strategy of challenging the logic of Roe. I don't think it'll prevail in the courts because abortion is part of the oligarch's agenda. The Supreme Court is there to do the oligarch's bidding in the final analysis. But the point here is putting all this energy into passing a human life amendment, or trying to get legislation passed. There were some legislation passed in the 90s that were vetoed by Bill Clinton about late-term abortions, which is particularly disgusting. The point is, if you produce a culture of life and you promote things like family, traditional sex roles, a return to chastity, not celibacy, but chastity, discipline, moral discipline, self-control, understanding there is a purpose and meaning to this, a logos to this type of behavior, you will, in effect, reduce abortion and save lives, as opposed to spending a lot of time and resources agitating, because the agitation is there to consume our energy and time. And, you know, we get all upset about who's going to be appointed to the Supreme Court and these things, or, the political process, the electoral process, the judicial process is there just to suck you in, to waste your time and energy, and again, promoting the culture of life, promoting family, these things, you will default to a pro-life position. Yeah. At least at the federal level. I think at the state level, you become, there's a scale to politics where it becomes more reasonable, and you can actually can affect positive change. To the extent that it's been federalized, it was there to create the very system we have today, which is sort of an insoluble political problem meant to divide everybody.
Tim, I'm just very curious about this, but if it's like a bad time to talk about, we can do it some other time. I'm just curious though, like when you use the expression logos, what do you mean? Do you have is it something that can actually be defined, or is it a little more metaphysical kind of thing that's sort of?
It's harder? Basically, it's the meaning. It's been bandied about lately by E. Michael Jones.
And I love how he talks about it.
Yeah, he's writing a book about it, and I've interviewed talking about it, read several articles about it. It's just understanding there's a meaning to things. There's a central, there is a teleocratic purpose to the universe, and we're all part of it. And so because of that, you can divine or understand this meaning by following the natural law based on understanding the universe. And if you follow the meaning to the universe, you won't get lost. And so there's a understanding, you can understand there's a whole purpose to, you know, there's a purpose and meaning to sex. And that's perfectly understandable to any reasonably intelligent adult. If they put aside their appetites and their base desires and use their intellect, and then you can, then these things that, you know, you can understand how these things are supposed to work. And you, and if you use them the way they're supposed to work, you won't get in trouble.
You know? Well, you also, you'll create a healthy culture. You know, you'll actually be moving towards something that's sustainable. And it's that kind of like family, you know, culture, ethnic sensation that I was talking about earlier. Like, this is where you really feel solid in the world, you know. Mm-hmm. Logos, it's just a fascinating word. One of the most interesting words.
It's Greek, so it has many meanings. You know, it comes to the Gospel of John. You know, the English translation is word, which isn't
good enough.
In the
Gospel of John, they translate it as word, which I think is a very poor translation. Yes. But the actual etymology of the word, I think, is more or less straightforward, even though there's some mystery. But it's about, at least as Heraclitus used it in a letter, a couple letters, they had the idea of God, and then it occurred to them that, well, God is not immutable. God does stuff, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Creates things. And so he has to think, he has to be aware of himself. And so then you had vocabulary developed, like nous, it's a Greek word, it's the mind of God. Mm-hmm. And then logos, which is basically kind of the activity of God, you know, and then, and that Heraclitus then used it in a moral sense, kind of like natural law. It's a little mysterious in the letter, but it looks pretty clear that he was saying that people forgot, you know, he says that they weren't really living up to what he saw as kind of their human potential because they forgot the logos. They forgot that there was basically an energy that was going through all things that had come from a divinity, which they should be aware of in their activity. See, so that's, I think that's actually would it's a little hard to fit that into gospel.
The problem is our default position is sort of the, I think, the British empiricism.
And
materialism's situational ethics, whereas the traditional way of thinking, the more would have been, you know, sort of divine law, natural law, moral objective, you know, more objective moral truth, and that's what guides your behavior, as opposed to situational ethics, moral relativism, and whatever works, pragmatism.
Tim, that is so wise of you to see this. People, I think it's kind of what is coming out of it, and that's why it'd be kind of nice if logos was become a more popular term, because basically it is the opposite of situational ethics.
Yeah. Keeps you from doing justifying bad things, right?
Remember, situational ethics is basically a road sign saying brave new world this way.
Yes.
Right? You're on your way for, you know, the pornographic male, single mom, you know, it's all the polysexualism. It's all taking you to being controlled by the state.
It goes back to like abortion. A woman finds herself, she gets pregnant because she had, you know, illicit sex, and now she's in trouble. There was a time when people thought themselves as being in trouble, when there was more shame in these things.
Yeah.
A solution isn't to kill them with a child, because that's not consistent with logos. So whatever your problem is, you're not going to make it better by killing the unborn child.
Well, you know, the thing that's useful about it is that the term logos is that it would provide a platform for being able to withstand kind of the verbal intimidation of the cultural Marxists.
Yes.
That's what I think is really important about the term. And I don't think you have to be a religious person to be able to use it. I think it's actually something that is, you can, when you refer to the world of the peace of the world of the natural order of a family,
mm-hmm.
man and woman and children, and of there being close relationships to the immediate family and their ethnicity. I mean, this is, you can, when it's attacked, because remember, the cultural Marxist, it's always the culture of critique. I mean, mm-hmm. look at the abortion political system. It's critique, right? You're evil and restraining the woman from being able to have an abortion, right? Because she's going to be killed by the child since she has a rare form of cancer or whatever, you know. So, but the thing is that In the culture of critique, you have to have a way to just sort of help people apply the brakes to the sophistry, try to expose the people. And I think logos is a pretty good term. I think it's actually pretty handy. And let's hope that it does become popular, because, if you start the argument looking backwards at a kind of natural law or, the historical sort of emotional structure that one comes from, and seeing this in a positive way instead of, like the Gregor Lukacs, the family is capitalism, the woman is property, the children are slaves, we have to let the Hungarian Soviet take control of the education, instead of that, if you say, there is this idea of logos, that there is a natural order that we have benefited from and has produced us. We are here today because of this. So maybe we're not completely willing just to throw our culture, our identity, our sexuality, throw everything away just because you have some sophist with a loud voice who has access to a television camera get on there and tell you you're a bad person,
Yeah, I mean, what it protects you if you tend to, if you're in touch with logos, you're not going to be taken in by, Gregor Lukacs or Alex or Ginsberg or something, Allen Ginsberg, these type of characters,
or Hugh Hefner,
whatever, some newcomer proposing some sort of deconstructive or innovation society. Like, wait a second, is this consistent with the logos?
I mean, so that's the thing, is that we need to have some way to criticize the cultural Marxists, for lack of a better term. I can lump a lot of these people into that term. We need a way for people to automatically be able to criticize them. Mm-hmm. And in the same way that in the 60s, if you brought the arguments of the cultural Marxists forward, you had some kind of person who had intellectual stature that would be basically in back of the term. I mean, think of, like Tim Leary or, Ken Kesey or the Beatles, right? I mean, these people had power. Well, when you think of the logos, you don't really, it doesn't, connect to individuals. But this is how it, I think this is really kind of like structurally in terms of our neural kind of semantics, what we have to do. And that's one of the reasons I really like E. Michael Jones' use of the term.
Yeah.
Because he's somebody who's a really good scholar, very clear-minded. His heart is as pure as gold. And so when people hear him explain the term, they then have this automatic way of like resisting the cultural Marxism. And also it links to someone who is kind of an intellectual authority.
Yeah.
That they can stand with against the intimidation.
Yeah, he's kind of like a he's kind of sort of like an intellectual father figure to many people. Yeah. He's got the grab. He's old. He's your age. He's got the gravitas. You have gravitas at that age.
Gravitas. Yeah. It is so embarrassing to be so old. I woke up the other day and I just said, I've got to fix this problem. I've got to get my hands on like the birth certificate or something, because it's too old to be reasonable.
Well, like I said, talk about logos, and there's nothing.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, there's no, I think, better example of a violation of logos than a mother killing her unborn child.
Well, it certainly brings up the question, doesn't it? And in other words, if you have all the exceptions, you have the idea of freedom as being presented, you have all of these ideas that come from the cultural Marxists, let's be honest. But then there is also just the natural world, the way of the past, the logos, mm-hmm. which you can say is the hand of God or whatever you want to call it. It's coming through us. It should be coming, it's in our DNA, to use an expression. Mm-hmm. And so in that world, in that process, abortions don't really fit in, do they? I mean, it just isn't, because the unborn child would have so much, it would have a lot of logos, if you know what I mean. I mean, it is literally biology creating the next generation. And so there would be a sacredness to it. And, if a woman doesn't experience that, though, which, of course, if you just graduated from UC Berkeley with a degree in queer study, you're probably not really going to have that very often. Then it's now you're, you know, now suddenly you're in the, you know, it's you're contesting, right? But in order to resist the genocide that the cultural Marxists have in mind, don't you think logos is kind of a useful term to, you know, kind of help people move in a better direction mentally with, you know?
Yeah, it gives them a firm grounding, a guiding light, an understanding, you know.
A guiding light as opposed to a Georgia guidestone.
And there's no, except there's no freedom outside the moral order, meaning that you have to operate within the moral law to be free, the same way you have to operate within the physical laws to survive. And if you violate the moral order, you will pay the consequences. There's no, because by acknowledging the moral order, what you're saying is my intellect controls my appetites and my base desires. So now I'm strong enough to be free because now I can make critical decisions. Whereas if my critical faculties are overtaken by my base desires, my appetites, I'm free to do whatever I want. I become a slave to my passions.
Well, and eventually a slave to the oligarchs.
Because they're the ones who can survive.
It's all heading right to the Brave New World.
Because they're the ones that will give you free pornography on the internet.
Yeah. There are limits to, you know, basically behavior if you're going to have power and a satisfying life. I mean, to have a really satisfying life, you have to have discipline, which means to say delayed gratification.
Yeah, if I'm free to eat anything, anytime I want, without regard to the, you know, the nutrition or the caloric intake, I'm free to eat that, but then I become morbidly obese and I can't move around and I die. I get sick.
Right.
So,
right.
Well, I mean, that's...
And you're free to be, you know, a pornographic male. This is freedom.
Yes.
Here I am. I'm 10 hours a day of pornography. And then when you get to be 50, 60, and you don't have any social connections that are meaningful, right? You're free to be just a lonely, miserable person and then look back on your life as completely artificial.
Yeah, you have nothing, absolutely nothing tying you down.
it's free as a bird. So that's the thing is that the word freedom is just used in a sophist sense. You know, they're just basically trying to take away from people typically the self-restraint that strength and virtue requires.
Yeah, well, English language is bad for philosophy. It's very good for commerce.
Yeah,
it's
for
bad
certain
for philosophy.
People's commerce, you know. But it isn't good for philosophy. The term logos is hard to find even a way to do it. That's why I asked you. I didn't mean to go personal with you, but I was curious about how you would react or how you use the term, because it isn't a word that is well understood, or even, you know, experts in like Bible scholarship agree on. There's lots of contests about what it means, and I really think that this is incorrect. We should try to have a really good, clear understanding of it and make the word common. It'd be a hard word to suppress. And it's also, you know, it's like a code word, you know? I mean, it's like a way that we can recognize one another in conversation.
I think it's good if it has a bumper sticker or a t-shirt.
I agree. I mean, I hear a lot of people talk about it, and, you know, they talk about it like it's logic or word, or, you know, they have all different ways, but it's really,
well, these are our sub meanings, because language by language,
yeah.
You know, obviously the written language is key to having an identity and being able to think, and so there is a relation between actual, you know, the unique ability of human beings to create language, and that is a reflection of our soul. This ability.
But it's to use it to, like in Gospel of John, they it's often in King James Version, they use the term word.
Yeah.
But I just think that's very, you know, it's, again, the word is very plastic, coherent, you know, idea of word. But, and as E. Michael Jones then, in an Anki interview with you, he was saying that, you know, word, it represents humans becoming basically, or, you know, conscious, you know, or they're able to articulate. So language is hand in hand with moral judgment and things. And I think this is a great idea, but it's not really what logos is, which is this, the activity of God, I guess best way. And when you forget that that is your what has made you, when you forget the logos, like the people that Heraclitus was talking to, you have really lost your way. And that's what cultural Marxism is. I was thinking about this the other day. That's really what cultural Marxism is. And I think it's kind of almost unconscious that people are responding to this word so often, to logos now, because what they're really doing, in my opinion, is they're finding vocabulary to fight back with, because the cultural Marxist takes you into anti-logos.
Yes.
Because all of your past, the things that created you, your family, your sexuality, your ethnic tradition, the idea that strength and virtue are the critical goals, that it isn't just sexual liberation that's important, right? But that strength and virtue are really what's critical. This is all logos, you see?
Yeah.
And so they attack that, and that's why, let's try to, I wouldn't be at all unhappy if that word becomes very widespread. It'd be great.
Yes.
So
logos is rising. So
logos rising.
Well, Joe.
Tim, thank you so much for the conversation, brother. We'll talk next week.
Enjoy the long weekend. We'll talk next week. Take it easy.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.